together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past.
Welcome to Madison Labor Radio. Labor Radio is dedicated to bringing news, information, and cultural events focused on working people and the labor movement to Madison area and surrounding communities. I'm Keith Steffen, a member of the National Association of Letter Carriers. Your support is necessary to make Labor Radio and all the great programming on WORT possible.
Hi, I'm Frida Ballard, a member of OPEIU Local 39. Today we catch up with workers at Madison Starbucks stores and get the latest news about organizing efforts, hear from the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin on two constitutional amendment proposals aimed at making voting harder, get an update on negotiations in Meritor, and much more.
But who defend the workers who cannot organize? And the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us.
It was a busy week in the Madison area for organizing at Starbucks, with two NLRB elections and a new store declaring for one. Greg Jaboski talked to Starbucks workers about what led to their victories.
It was a big week, nationally and in the Madison area, for union organizing at stores of the Seattle-based multinational coffee giant Starbucks. On Monday, the number of union Starbucks stores in the Madison area doubled from 2 to 4 as Starbucks workers at its Madison Rimrock Street and Monona Broadway Street stores voted overwhelmingly to join Starbucks Workers United in simultaneous National Labor Relations Board supervised elections. Just moments after the Rimrock Starbucks closed out its election, with 14 of the 17 workers in this bargaining unit voting 13-1 to join the union, Labor Radio spoke outside the store to Alex Taylor, a barista at the Madison Rimrock Street Starbucks and a member of the store's union organizing committee.
I expected to have an overwhelming win. 13-1 was even bigger than I expected, though. And I think it just shows that everybody in this store believes in the power of us workers together as a collective. We're not here to fight upper management. That's not our goal at all. Our goal is to unite with each other and provide just a better work environment. That's really all we hope for here.
Taylor sees Monday's successful union vote and the organizing drive that led to it as bringing workers together.
Been working very hard along multiple people within the store, working to find a better environment for everyone here. And at this moment, I feel like that's coming together and I can see it happening. And that just makes me very happy.
Then there were some new arrivals who drove up and got out at the Rimrock store. A group including Starbucks Workers United organizer Hannah Fogarty showed up from the Monona store with more good news for the workers. 11 workers of the 14-member Monona store unit had voted 9-2 to unionize. Labor Radio spoke to an excited Esme Hill Gorman, a barista at the Broadway Street Starbucks in Monona and a member of the store's union organizing committee, who described the drive there.
So it was about 2 or 3 months in that I started organizing and speaking with Hannah. And I just slowly started gaining trust with people. And then I started discussing it in an open-minded way that was just, you know, you can believe whatever you want, but we want to have an open discussion about it because it's a pretty important topic and it could help a lot of people in our store. And it just slowly progressed and I got more and more people on board. I got more people in the committee and yeah, it went really well.
Bill Gorman spoke of the support the union received from Starbucks customers.
Most of the customers, our regulars, were very supportive. They love us as a team. They've seen a lot of turnover throughout the years, and they just wanted something that we were able to do to empower us as employees. So they were in support.
Then, on Tuesday, more news. Starbucks Workers United announced that 9 additional Starbucks stores across the country, including the new East Washington and First Street store in Madison, had filed notices to join the union. Labor Radio spoke yesterday to Q Mossman, a shift supervisor at the East Washington Street Starbucks and a member of the store's union organizing committee, who told about what happened at their store, which went from opening to unionizing in a matter of months.
Our store opened last August, and we just started seriously talking about unionizing just a couple weeks ago. I was kind of involved right from the beginning of that when we started getting in contact with Hannah and some of the other Starbucks staff members from other stores who are unionized right now, just to know what the process is like, sort of what we need to do. So I've been involved pretty much right from the beginning.
Mossman says they and the Washington Street Starbucks workers were inspired by organizing locally and nationally.
Yeah, we're definitely all especially pretty familiar with what's been going on in Madison. We all have friends that work at other stores and just kind of know people that have been a part of this whole unionizing process here in Madison. And then obviously it's been pretty big nationally over the past couple years. So while we weren't super familiar with all of like the little details, we were all familiar with the general, you know, what's been going on in general across the nation with more and more stores unionizing.
Esme Hill Gorman believes everyone at Starbucks should join the union.
It is a great way to empower yourself as an employee. It's a great way to come together as a team for a better work life. And it can make huge improvements, even just by filing. There are huge improvements made to your store almost instantly. And it's just super exciting, really thrilling. And I think everyone should get involved.
That was Esme Hill Gorman, a barista at the Rimrock Street Starbucks, and as of Monday, an official member of Starbucks Workers United. On Monday, both the Madison Rimrock Street and Monona Broadway Street stores voted to join Starbucks Workers United, and on Tuesday, the union announced that the East Washington Street and First Street Starbucks had joined 8 others nationally in filing with the NLRB for recognition elections. Representatives of Starbucks management, who were present at the Rimrock store as the election closed there on Monday, declined to speak to Labor Radio. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Chabosky.
Internationally, forced labor is getting worse, stealing wages from workers and forcing them to work under dangerous conditions. Carol Weidel has a story.
The International Labor Organization, or ILO, a UN agency, reported that forced labor worldwide has risen to the obscene amount of $236 billion per year. Sexual exploitation is to blame for three-fourths of the take from a business that deprives migrants of money they can send home, swipes jobs from legal workers, and allows criminals to dodge taxes. The ILO said the tally for 2021, the most recent year covered in this international study, marked an increase of 37%, or $64 billion, compared with a decade prior. That's the result of both more people being exploited and more cash generated from each victim, according to the ILO. The report, Profits in Poverty, The Economics of Forced Labor, estimates that traffickers and criminals are generating close to $10,000 per victim, up from $8,269 a decade ago. The ILO defines forced labor as work that's imposed against the will of the employee and extracted under penalty or the threat of one. After forced commercial sexual exploitation, the U.S. sector with the highest annual illegal profits from forced labor is industry at $35 billion, followed by services at $20.8 billion, agriculture at $5 billion, and domestic work at $2.6 billion. These illegal profits are wages that rightfully belong in the pockets of workers but instead remain in the hands of their exploiters as a result of their coercive practices. ILO Director Gilbert Wango released this statement. Forced labor perpetuates the cycle of poverty and exploitation and strikes at the heart of human dignity. We know that the situation has only gotten worse. The international community must urgently come together to take action and to end this injustice. This story was sourced from the International Labor Organization. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Carol Weidel.
Early voting in the Wisconsin spring election has started. Regular voting will take place on Election Day, Tuesday, April 2nd. The ballot will include the option to select a presidential primary candidate for a specific party. All other candidates on the ballot are for nonpartisan seats. Citizens can register to vote by bringing proof of residence to their municipal clerk until the Friday before Election Day, or by bringing proof of residence to their polling place on Election Day. Citizens can find their polling place and see what is on their ballot by going to myvote.wi.gov and entering their address. That's myvote.wi.gov. The back of the ballot will ask voters to weigh in on two constitutional amendments. Information about the amendments is our next story.
The League of Women Voters in Wisconsin is urging voters to vote no on both constitutional amendments that will be on the April 2nd ballot. Labor Radio spoke to Sue Jenick from the League about the proposed amendments.
My name is Sue Jenick, and I am the program director for the Dane County League of Women Voters, and I also serve as the chair of the legislative committee of the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin.
On April 2nd, there's going to be two proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot. Can you tell us a bit about each amendment and why the League of Women Voters is urging people to vote no?
Well, both of the amendments have to do with election administration. The first one is a total ban on the use of private donations or grants in election administration. And this comes out of the 2020 election in the April primary in 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic. There were huge problems in running elections. In Milwaukee, there were only 5 polling places open and people had to stand in line in the freezing rain for a long time. After that, a foundation that was funded by Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, decided to make available to municipalities throughout the country monies for election administration. And in Wisconsin, over 200 municipalities applied for and received that money, including the biggest cities, of course, and since they have more population, each one of them got more than a lot of the smaller locations. Some people weren't happy with that and decided that the answer is to totally ban private donations in election administration. But this total ban could create problems for municipalities. If we have another crisis that makes it difficult to run elections, or even if a municipality is short on money, they can either change their procedure and make it less expensive for them, meaning longer lines, inefficiencies, difficulties for voters, or they can raise taxes to make up the difference. And the League doesn't think that either one of those are a good option.
What about this second proposed constitutional amendment?
This one says that only election officials designated by law may perform tasks in the conduct of elections. It's kind of a mystery why this has been proposed. We have a whole section of the state statutes that goes into detail on running elections and provides that only election officials can be involved in running elections. It's totally unnecessary. Certainly doesn't belong in our Constitution. But the way this is worded could present difficulties for the clerks who are responsible for running elections. What does it mean to perform tasks? There's lots of tasks in the conduct of running an election, and not all of them may be done by election officials now. For example, the manufacturer of the voting machines may provide a consultant or a technician to the clerks if there's a problem with a voting machine. That person wouldn't be an election official. There's all kinds of people who are involved with the running of an election, and it is not clear how this would be applied.
Why are legislatures proposing these constitutional amendments?
Both of these proposals were included in a bill that was passed by the legislature in 2021 and then vetoed by the governor. It really is an end run around the governor's right to veto legislation.
That was Sue Jenick of the League of Women Voters of Dane County. This is Janine Ramsey reporting for Madison Labor Radio.
Support staff at Unity Point Meritor paused negotiations this week. They face a tough challenge.
Contract negotiations between Unity Point Meritor and SEIU Wisconsin will resume next week. The union hopes that last week's mobilization focus on turnover will show Meritor that the staff are determined to make progress and that the hospital will take this week to formulate a reasonable response to the union. Since the contract mobilization began several weeks ago, according to the union, membership has increased and become more involved. Part of this increase in participation stems from the open bargaining method used by the union. All members are invited to the bargaining sessions and can listen in via Zoom. That way, members can hear directly what management thinks of them, and the result has been increased anger at management when, as in last week's session, management characterized the workers as a commodity. The issue for the union is turnover, which is directly linked to wages. Inadequate wages contribute to high turnover, and as of last week, the union and the company were far apart. In addition, there are issues of scheduling. Meritor Hospital is no longer the community Madison General Hospital of years past. In 1987, it merged with Methodist Hospital, another community-based hospital, to become Meritor. In 2014, the Des Moines-based Unity Point Hospital Corporation reached a merger agreement with Meritor, and the hospital became part of the Unity Point Group, which has hospitals in Iowa and Illinois. In other words, Meritor has moved beyond the community-based hospital of the past to become part of a chain of non-union hospitals, thus making it a much more powerful adversary. I am Frank Emsbach for Madison Labor Radio.
Employees of the Volkswagen plant near Chattanooga, Tennessee, have taken the next step towards unionizing with the United Auto Workers. Labor Radio has the story.
Auto workers at the Volkswagen production plant located outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee, have formally filed a petition for an election with the National Labor Relations Board, bringing them one step closer to winning union representation with the United Auto Workers. They are the first location to seek an election as a part of the UAW's ambitious campaign to organize over a dozen non-union auto manufacturing plants across the country, which was announced late last year. The Chattanooga plant was also one of the first to initially go public with their organizing drive, joining with a Mercedes plant in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and announcing late in the fall. According to the petition filed with the NLRB on Tuesday, the potential bargaining unit encompasses 4,300 workers. In their announcement of the election, the union said that they enjoyed a supermajority of support among that group. Although they did not give an exact percentage, the union has previously advised workers to gain signatures with at least 70% of a bargaining unit before seeking an election with the NLRB. The union has also been active in the lead-up to the election announcement, filing a half dozen complaints with the board since the start of the year over alleged intimidation, surveillance, and other unfair labor practices committed against employees of the plant by Volkswagen. President Joe Biden weighed in on the petition on Tuesday, stating, quote, "As one of the world's largest automakers, many Volkswagen plants internationally are unionized. I believe that American workers, too, should have a voice at work. The decision of whether to join a union belongs to the workers," end quote. The result of the election at the Chattanooga plant may prove to be an augury for the union's flagship effort to organize over 150,000 non-union auto workers across the country, an effort that the union has pledged $40 million toward supporting. This is, in fact, the union's third attempt at representing the plant's workers since 2014. But the first since their historic wave of strikes last year earned significant gains across GM, Ford, and Stellantis, which could give them a leg up in earning worker support this time around. The election at Chattanooga will thus be a critical first test of the UAW's new strategy and perhaps mandate to make inroads into the largely non-union South and West. In the meantime, the union's petition requests dates of April 17th, 18th, and 19th to hold the election, which will most likely receive the board's review in the near future. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Sean Hagerup.
March 12th was Equal Pay Day. But how equal is pay comparing women to men? Carol Weidel has the story.
The Census Bureau released a report on the gender pay gap among certificate degree graduates and those from top schools with a bachelor's degree program. Previous report compared earnings of men and women and how it varied with social, economic, and demographic characteristics. Comparing male earnings to female earnings, the pay gap is similar in the certificate degree programs at 71% and bachelor programs at 72%. However, this new report analyzed earnings of graduates across a range of post-high school education levels. When comparing earnings of workers from certificate programs, occupational choices explained 38% of the differences in earnings. For those earning a bachelor's degree, the gap was similar, 32%. There has been little progress in narrowing this gender wage gap over the past three decades. While the pay gap declined between 1979 and 1994 due to men's stagnant wages, not a tremendous increase in women's wages, it has remained mostly flat since then. Women are paid 22% less on average than men in 2023 after controlling for race and ethnicity, education, age, and geographic division, according to the Economic Policy Institute. The experience of men and women across the wage distribution differs considerably, but the wage gap persists no matter how it's measured. Women are paid less than men as a result of occupational segregation, devaluation of women's work, societal norms, and discrimination, all of which took root well before women entered the labor market. Despite gains in educational attainment over the last five decades, women still face a significant gap. Among workers, women are more likely to graduate from college than men and more likely to receive a graduate degree than men. Even so, women are paid less than men at every educational level. Among workers who have only a high school diploma, women are paid 21% less than men. Among workers who have a graduate degree, women are paid 27% less than men. That gap of $13.52 an hour translates to roughly $28,000 less annual earnings for a full-time worker. Women with an advanced degree also experienced a significant wage gap at 25% in 2023. What's very stark from the data is that women with advanced degrees are paid less per hour on average than men with college degrees. Men with a college degree are paid $50 an hour on average, compared with $48 for women with advanced degrees. Sources for this story are the Census Bureau and the Economic Policy Institute. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Carol Weidel.
The state of Georgia is poised to make unionizing even more difficult with a new bill that passed through their legislature this week, opening another front in the reaction against organized labor. Labor Radio discusses the bill's origins and consequences.
The General Assembly of Georgia ratified new legislation this week that would punish employers that voluntarily recognize unions. Under the new law, which was passed with a party-line vote by the state Senate last month and state House on Wednesday, the government will bar employers that do not require a full NLRB election for workers organizing a union from accessing state subsidies and other economic incentives. Georgia's governor, Brian Kemp, has previously indicated his backing of the bill, so it is probable that it will be signed into law, though the bill's conflict with established interpretations of federal labor law is likely to invite challenges in court. Shortly after the bill's passage, AFL-CIO President Liz Schuler joined Georgian labor leaders in calling the legislation, quote, an appalling bill that attacks the fundamental freedoms of workers and business owners, end quote, in a publicly released statement. The state's new law is part of a broader effort to see workers' rights to organize eroded at the state level, or to see anti-union decisions applied by federal courts when the constitutionality of the bills are challenged. The Associated Press reported last month that the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council has been pushing Republican-led states to implement laws with language similar to the bill passed in Georgia. It is also possible that these states are looking for a response to the NLRB's recent CEMEX ruling, which could increase the frequency of card check union recognitions. Within this larger context, southern states are leading the charge to see these restrictions enshrined in the law. Legislation with similar language on voluntary recognition passed the Tennessee legislature last year and was signed by GOP Governor Bill Lee. Alabama's state legislature just introduced their own version of the bill this week. It is no small coincidence, then, that all three states are also currently at the center of an intense campaign to organize non-union auto manufacturing plants by the United Auto Workers. Further still, this is one of many legal efforts to stifle a growing tide of union activity across the country, efforts including a challenge to the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Board itself by several companies, among them SpaceX, Starbucks, Trader Joe's, and Amazon. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Sean Hagerup.
Up next is Labor History from the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1972. That was the day the Equal Rights Amendment passed the U.S. Senate and moved to the states for ratification. It had passed the House the previous fall. Alice Paul and Crystal Eastman of the National Women's Party first wrote the ERA in the 1920s. It was introduced to Congress in 1923. The revised version that Congress passed in 1971 and 1972 stated simply, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex." The amendment needed 38 states to ratify by March of 1979 in order to pass. 35 states ratified the amendment, but 5 states later rescinded ratification. The 38-state requirement was never met. The decades-long debate among women's rights advocates often centered on formal equality versus protective legislation for women workers. But an amendment establishing equality meant the end to restrictive discriminatory laws. These included laws imposing restriction on a woman's right to buy or sell property or to conduct a business, the age at which women could marry, differing admission standards for boys and girls in tax-supported educational institutions, laws establishing different jail sentences by sex for identical crimes, regulations denying unemployment compensation payments to pregnant women who are still able and willing to work, and much more. The far right and religious fundamentalists of all faiths fiercely opposed the ERA, fearing it would erode traditional gender roles. Many progressives and the labor movement also opposed it for many years on the basis that hard-won protective legislation would be lost. It is striking that, as of 2017, there is still no clear legal codification of women's equal status to men.
Thanks for listening to Madison Labor Radio. I'm Frida Ballard. Thanks to editor Frank Emsbach, assistant Robin G., copy editor Simon Gordon, reporters Greb Jaboski, Carol Weidel, Janine Ramsey, Sean Hagerup, and damage control specialist Joanne Powers. Special thanks to Keith Steffen, our reader coordinator, engagement editor Alice Herman, and to all of our readers and the members of IBEW Local 2304 WORT Staff Collective.
And I'm Keith Steffen. We would also like to thank all of the generous contributors to Labor Radio and WORT. Please stay tuned for the Blues Cruise with Dave Watts and the Professor Bill Clark.